Welcome to the Investing in Real Estate podcast with Clayton Morris. This is the show where we focus on buy and hold real estate. Why do we do it? We do it for the purposes of creating passive income and legacy wealth for you and your family. If you're interested in finding your freedom number, come over to our website at morrisinvest.com/freedom and download your free financial freedom cheat sheet today. Welcome in, everybody, to the Investing in Real Estate show. I'm your host, Clayton Morris, a longtime real estate investor, having flipped thousands of homes. And I, as you know, we talk about on this podcast specifically buy and hold real estate for the purposes of creating passive income and creating legacy wealth for you and your family. We focus on residential real estate. That's our bread and butter. And you know my bread and butter, single family homes in some great Midwest markets that have been able to consistently cash flow for many, many years. I'm excited because we have a great guest on the show today, someone who's been in the business for a long time and who understands a lot of the ups and downs, who's been through the crash, who's written about all variants in real estate investing, buy and hold, turnkey, et cetera, you name it. Brian Klein is the author of the book, How to Pay Little or No Taxes on Your Real Estate Investments, What Smart Investors Need to Know, Explained Simply. He's also written How to Read and Understand Financial Statements When You Don't Know What You're Looking At for Business Owners and Investors. And he's also currently a frequent contributing writer for RealtyBizNews.com. Brian, nice to have you on the show today.
It's great to be here, Clayton. I really appreciate an opportunity to help your audience learn what's going on and stay current with the current market, as well as learn from the past.
Well, let's talk about learning from the past a little bit before we get to where the current market is. And obviously, you watch a lot of the trends. That's how I first learned about you, through Realty Biz News and some of the current articles that you've been writing over there. And so that's why I said I want to get Brian on the show to talk about the current trends in the business. But you have a long track record in this business. And I mean, you back in 2006, you were already in the thick of the real estate meltdown. The mortgage defaults began increasing. Take me back to that time. What were you doing in real estate investing at the time, and what were you seeing?
Well, you know, the market kind of peaked just before 2007 and started falling apart in 2008, and people were in a lot of trouble. Mortgages started getting foreclosed on, and people were trying to figure out, I'm talking about people that just own their own homes at this point, and there was a lot of opportunity for investors in the foreclosure market and short sales and even helping people wade their way through the whole program as advisors. And I got invested in, or I got interested in, a subject that I call the mortgage solution formula, which help people figure out their alternatives to turning in keys to the mortgage companies and going through the foreclosure process without terribly hurting their credit history. And that became part of the short sale process, which not many people knew about at the time, but you could sell for less than your underwater mortgage and come out in not too bad a shape. And today we're seeing those people come out of foreclosure now, and any damage they had to their credit report is pretty much behind them now, and people are poised to invest in real estate again, even those investors that struggled through those times.
What do you think was one of the biggest takeaways from the crash?
Real estate is a cyclical business, and you don't want to buy at the top of the market or in a bubble, which is what happened to a lot of people. They were they just thought real estate would go up and up and up, and in reality, we all found out that there is a top end to it. And sometimes you have to sit back and just hold your investments and collect the passive income, and not try to make big profits on too many deals, because eventually, there's no money left in the market.
Right. Did you see a lot of, looking back and then looking forward, do you see any similarities today to what we saw in 2006, 2007? Or have we corrected those mistakes?
I think a lot of the problems and mistakes from that period of time have corrected themselves to a big degree. I think it's a different market today. It's a tighter market. There's mortgages are difficult to qualify for. Creative financing is more important to investors today than it probably ever has been before. I actually think there's a lot of money in private financing that people should be trying to tap into. The baby boomers in particular, have a lot of money that was in the stock market. They lost a big chunk of it, and they don't want to lose any more, and they're not going back into the stock market. They're looking for secure investments, and they're taking their 401ks and their IRAs and making that money available to finance people's mortgages. And it's a good secure investment for them because they've got a real tangible asset that historically has always gone up in value, although there are dips in the market.
Yeah, being able to take that money and roll it over, to a self-directed 401k?
Yeah, I think that's just that's exactly it. And it's a form of, you've seen a lot of institutional buyers move into the same market. Blackstones and other big buyers have gone in and bought up a lot of the foreclosed houses and turned them into rentals. And on the smaller scale, the individual investors are doing much the same thing, although with the 401ks, they're not the outright property owner. They're providing the funding for investors that are actually the landlords of the property. So it's kind of a win-win situation for both the people with the 401ks to invest as well as people that are looking to make real estate investments today.
That's great. Were you investing at the time back in 2006, or were you writing about it? How were your investments back during the crash?
Well, mostly I was out of the market at the time. I got out. I got out right around 2007, and I did sit on the sidelines and I tried to help some people work their way through it. And then I got back into the market, and I didn't get back in until late 2011, when I think I was fortunate enough to buy at pretty much the bottom of the market when it was just coming back out of the serious dip. And I'm pretty happy with what I've been able to do since then. There have been opportunities, and right at the bottom, there were a lot of houses available because there weren't a lot of people investing at the time. And today, the market's pretty tight, but there's still opportunities for those that want to go out and do the research and find the houses. There are always distressed houses on the market.
You're up in the Pacific Northwest, up where the beautiful big trees and rainy, beautiful weather, but amazing mountains. Where do you invest? Do you invest up there or other parts of the country?
I pretty much invest up here because I do understand the local market, and you don't always have to invest in a local market, but you need to understand the market that you're investing in. So I'm not too far from, I am way out in the rural area up in the trees and living on mountainside, but I'm actually not too far from Seattle, which is the hottest residential real estate market in the country right now. So there are lots of opportunities, and they're spread way out beyond the city limits into the suburbs and outlying areas. And it looks like that market in particular is going to thrive for some time to come. There's a lot of movement of technology companies out of the San Francisco area and up into Seattle, and the companies themselves are moving, and people follow the money. So real estate's been appreciating double digit up here for quite a while and looks to be doing so for the future.
Today's episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter.com. Now, I'm serious, and I'm wearing my business suit here for a little bit, because for all of you people out there who are in business, whether you're a sole proprietor or you're in HR and you have to do the hiring, well, you have the most important job of the business, because this company is but one of the greatest inventions in the past several years, ZipRecruiter.com. In fact, at Morris Invest, we're in the process of hiring a couple of people right now, some of our client relations specialists and some other members of our team. But we're not just going to throw out ads on Craigslist and get some terrible candidate for the job. It's ridiculous. So with ZipRecruiter.com, that's what we're going to use. You can post to 200-plus job boards, including social networks, all with a single click. So what you can do is then you can screen the potential employee, you can rate them, and then you can hire the right candidate very, very fast. So your company, you know, it's made up of people, and it's good, right? And right employee can send your company to the roof, but the wrong hire, as you probably already know, can bring it down to the ground. So that's why it's important that when the time comes, and it's hard, I know, but when you're short on staff, you don't want to look for staff. So you want to look for a replacement, but ZipRecruiter makes it so easy. So you search for a job, but you can also post a job. It's awesome. Post one job to ZipRecruiter.com, and it goes to more than 200 different job boards. And they've also expanded, of course, to Twitter and Facebook. So the idea is you want to get that job listing in front of as many people as you can, as quickly as possible and as widely as possible. There are millions of companies, some of them the biggest companies in the world, using ZipRecruiter. And our little company is using it as well. You can post, watch the candidates roll in. No more juggling emails, no more phone calls. That's the best part about it. You get to go through and see who the best candidates are, and you're not being flooded with emails from different people. So find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/investing. ZipRecruiter.com/investing. One more time, do it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/investing. Thanks, ZipRecruiter, for your support of the Investing in Real Estate podcast. So when you look at the current market, when you compare it to what we saw during the crash, and this is obviously an area you keep your finger on the pulse. You get that question a lot. You know, what are we heading towards another bubble? We see different articles written about that. And the articles seem to suggest that no, we're not, that some of the fundamentals have really shifted. How do you see it?
Pretty much just the way you explained it. I did recently write an article about, is it time to sell your investments? And I would be cautious about that. I'd be holding on to them at this point. I'm a believer in always taking a close look and constantly looking at your portfolio and understanding which ones are your biggest cash flowing properties, the ones that are delivering the most cash for the least investment, as opposed to those that are borderline. They may be profitable, but they're not delivering as much income as other properties could be. And you might want to look at what you could trade those for, I don't know, through a 1031 exchange or just selling and buying. But you might want to take a look at some of your lowest performing properties and moving into new properties, as long as they will cash flow better than the one that you're holding and your expenses don't exceed a year's worth of profits or less. So that's kind of what I see the market doing right at the moment.
And if you're about to get into real estate investing for the first time, what would be some of your advice if people are thinking about picking up a property for the first time?
I think that's a great question, because I think young people should be getting into the market right now, getting in and holding and building wealth that they can even transfer to their children as time goes on. And single-family housing is always a great place to start. Over the years, commercial becomes more attractive to those people, but the single-family market, and what we're seeing is the generation that's coming up into the first-time buyers, millennials, and that group of people, they're buying not so much in the suburbs, but closer into the city, not in the... Some of them are buying in the downtown city, but those that are starting families tend to be buying single-family houses right on the edge of the city. And that looks like a great opportunity for investment. The rental market's phenomenal right now. It's the vacancy rate in most places is less than 5%. So just about all the housing's rented out now for investors. That's a great trend.
Right. That's exactly the way it is for us too. Occasionally you get a property, you know, that it's just an anomaly. It'll get rented, but maybe it's sitting vacant for a month, you know, or a month and a half. And you're like, okay. And then finally get a good tenant in there. That tenant tends to stay 3 years, you know. Not every property rents up super fast, but most of ours rent up really fast. And it's because those fundamentals are there, right? There's such a demand for rental properties. And these, you know, builders aren't building homes for these folks. I mean, so there's, you know, it's a great time to go into these neighborhoods and pick up single family homes like we do, you know, in these neighborhoods, these established neighborhoods, and builders are building for that A-class market, you know, that luxury, not I would say luxury market, but in the $100,000 to $180,000 range, right?
Exactly. And, if you can find a house that was built, in the late 1990s or the early 2000s, it's relatively modern, and you can get it for a good price where it cash flows positive. There's a huge demand for those houses, and there's going to be for some time to come. I do think that people and investors especially, I think they're going to continue to buy single-family houses, but the rental market should be really appealing to investors right now.
Yeah. And, you know, millennials who are looking to buy a property you know, that's why they're moving out of the city. They're moving a little bit into the suburbs, but closer to the city. And they want some of those, you know, they want that 3-bedroom, 1-bath house. But again, those are going to be in those A-class neighborhoods where you're going to pay $150,000. There was a story out of Texas just this past week, first time home buyer market, and the builders there going after those first time home buyers. Offering some incentives, but the average price of the home is like $170,000. So for me, my properties for rents are going to be in the $40,000 range, $50,000 range, you know, in those established older neighborhoods. So it's such a great time.
Yes, it really is. And developers, I'm not completely sure what's keeping developers out of the market. I guess the only thing I can see is the profits in those higher priced houses are definitely higher, but there's a market out there and somebody's going to come in and start filling that need for the entry level buyers. There's plenty of them out there that would love to get into a house. And until that need is met, those people are going to be renters, and exactly what you described, on the outer edges of the city. Transportation's a big deal to these people. They want to be able to get into the city in less than 20 minutes. They like mass transportation. Those are some of the best neighborhoods to get into when you can get into them for the right price. There's nothing more important than understanding the neighborhoods that you're investing in.
Well, precisely. People want to know, they'll say, oh, you're kind of near a busy street. Yes, exactly. I'm near a busy street. I'm one block away from a busy street because that's where the bus stops. And that's where a lot of my renters want to take public transportation, or they want to go to the bus stop, or the train stop to and from work. So yeah, absolutely. That's why I want to own properties near public transportation. You personally might want to live up in the mountains with beautiful big trees. And me personally with my kids might want to live on a cul-de-sac in the suburbs, nowhere near a bus stop. But when you're renting, you know, you don't necessarily want to own a car. You want to be there and be able to have that, you know, jump on a bus and go to your the job at the Raytheon factory, you know, making engine parts, right?
Exactly. And it's more than just the commute to work. These younger people that are really active in starting families and getting their careers going, they also want to be close to centers of entertainment. They want to be able to get to the first run movie theaters and some of the better restaurants and of course the beer pubs and the martini houses and all the stuff that goes along with that. They still want to be connected to that city.
Right. Absolutely. And you see these great little urban areas popping up. And for, you know, where one of my favorite markets where I invest is Indianapolis. And so downtown Indianapolis was dead 10 years ago. There was nothing to do down there. And now there's craft brew houses and there's, you know, nightlife and there's a movie theater and it's a hopping place to go. Same thing with Detroit. You know, you had all these Brooklyn investors bringing in all these artists who were, you know, being priced out of Brooklyn. And now they've built up and bought these art studios where they paint, and coffee shops have popped up, and craft brew houses have popped up, and areas that were dead are now starting to thrive.
I completely agree. Some of the big money in real estate, the big institutional buyers, and those that buy skyscrapers and things that most of us investors can't even dream about investing in, they're even moving to what are called 18-hour cities, the cities that traditionally don't have gourmet restaurants open at 2 o'clock in the morning. The 24-hour cities are what are also known as the gateway cities, San Francisco, Manhattan, those Los Angeles. The 18-hour cities are becoming very attractive to big money, and small money typically follows the bigger money. And the outside areas around those 18-hour cities are becoming are going to be seeing some real increases in prices and investment opportunities.
You have written an article on the website on Realty Biz News about young people and reaping the benefits of investing it at a young age. You know, I spoke to an investor today who's 25 and he's just buying a property with us for the first time. And I said, my God, when I was 25, I wish I would have been that smart. So I don't know. Do you think young people understand it, or are they just avoiding real estate?
That's a hard question to answer. I hope they understand it, because there's nothing like buying when you're 25 years old. And even if you take out a 30-year mortgage, although you might be better off taking a 20-year mortgage, and by the time you're in your early 50s, you own the property free and clear. And if you're living in it, you don't have a mortgage payment. If you're renting it out, all that cash is just passive income coming in every month for the rest of your life. You can pass that property on to your children. It's just an incredible investment that pays you for the rest of your life if you just stay with it and buy some more. I think it's great for young people to be getting in the market right now.
When you talked about mortgages, and of course, a lot of our buyers, you know, will pay cash and then they'll refinance later because just banks aren't willing to do sure. loans on properties below 50K. It's too risky for them. And plus they just don't make much money on it. You know, they'd much rather be doing loans on $300,000 homes. But you wrote an article recently about Fannie and Freddie, which of course the two government sponsored enterprises. What has changed with – we're seeing some shifts right now. I want to get your perspective on what the Dodd-Frank law looks like, where we are with Fannie and Freddie, the conventional loan market. What does that look like these days?
I think it's quite a bit up in the air. It's literally going to take an act of Congress to sort all that out, and Congress moves very slow. I think there's big change coming, but I think it's going to come slowly. I think right at this moment, the crystal ball kind of looks like it's going to go towards more of a privatization of Fannie and Freddie. Government might start getting out of it, and we've had the big move of institutional buyers into the single-family home market over the last couple of years. And I don't know, it's a lot of money to take Fannie and Freddie private. I think the number is somewhere around $11 trillion, some number that I can't even imagine. But it'll probably evolve over some time where financing private homes is going to become more private financing and a little bit less dependent on government. There'll probably be some regulation in there to hopefully keep housing affordable to the average citizen. I would certainly hope it would work out that way.
Explain what you think is going to happen with Dodd-Frank. I've been reading reports that it looks like it's almost all but dismantled at this point. Dodd-Frank, of course, one of the regulatory bills put in place after the crash to keep there's a whole bunch of different things, but speculative investing, not lending to people that didn't have a job. It made for a lot of mortgage companies, a lot of banks, a lot of onerous paperwork, right? I mean, it literally put huge stacks of paper on their desk that they had to get signed, right?
That's absolutely right, and that's part of the reason why mortgages are so difficult to get today. The regulations have just piled all that paperwork up. The qualifications are much more difficult. I know when I started investing, it wasn't very hard to get a loan for a house at all. I remember one that I bought, a developer had a rental house, and he was at the same time he was developing a golf course, and he had no income from the golf course, and he had to sell a rental to generate income, and I just put in an application for a loan, and the bank asked for a paper trail, and it wasn't real clear where all the money was coming from, and I stalled for a week or two, and all of a sudden the loan was approved. And it's not that like that anymore. And that's part of the reason why I think it's going to go away from some of the big banks being the primary lenders with backing by Fannie and Freddie. And we're going to see it's not going to happen overnight, but I think we're going to see it move towards the private sector more, where it's not regulated quite so heavily, and investors, the money people, can make decisions based on merits on individual properties instead of big regulation. I don't know. Could be wrong. Like, crystal ball is not all that clear.
Well, that's more like, the private market. So a lot of people getting private loans or even private institutional loans, you know, they care about you, but they care more about the asset. You know, if they're going to give you 75% loan to value on this asset, they just want to know, you know, they just want to know that the fundamentals are sound. They're renting, they're giving the money based on the property, not 5 years of your tax returns. And, oh, you bought a car 3 years ago. You know, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, the amount, I have people who, you know, are millionaires who try to get loans, and they end up, you know, having to go through like 5-6 weeks of paperwork in order to get approved.
Yeah, and that doesn't work real well when there's bidding wars going on out there, because those houses are selling pretty quickly. So it's better if you can find an alternative source of financing in most cases. And, you know, the beginning investors, you mentioned that a lot of the people you work with are do a lot of all cash deals, but a lot of new investors just don't have that option. And creative financing is always at the root of investing, from what I've seen, and finding ways to put the deal together, be it seller financing with a balloon payment, or finding somebody with money they want to invest with into an asset, loan money against, with an asset that they know isn't going away, and it's almost certainly going to increase in value. That's the private side of the equation, and it works for investors pretty well.
Yeah, it really does. And we've had a lot of investors that not only use cash, but a lot of times it's cash from private money that they've been able to put together because the numbers make sense. You know, with a net ROI between 10 and 12%, it's a no-brainer for a lot of investors. So, well, this has been great.
That money market's yeah, the money market's only paying pennies on the dollar. A 12% investment is pretty good these days.
Yeah, for sure. I want to get you out of here on this, Brian. You talk about local markets. You know, people always want to paint the market with one broad brush. You know, that is to say, well, what's happening in the real estate investing world right now? And I think a great point that you made in an article I read by you a couple months ago was about, you know, that real estate isn't like buying or selling milk and eggs. That there's no, it's not one big market. You know, what happens in California is different than what's happening in your neck of the woods up in Seattle, or in my neck of the woods in New Jersey, or where we invest, you know, in parts of Florida and Michigan and Indianapolis. You can't paint everything with one broad brush, can you?
No, not at all. You know, example is the Seattle market's extremely hot right now, and it's if you want to buy a decent four-bedroom, a bigger house, a four-bedroom with two or three baths, you're going to be paying $450,000 for it. And at the same time, in the Midwest, you can still buy houses for $35,000-$40,000. So you can see there's an enormous difference in from one market to another. And you can't paint it with a broad brush. Any investor needs to know their local market. There's a reason why one axiom of real estate has always been location, location, location. If you can't pick a house up and move it, wouldn't it be great to pick up that $35,000 house in the Midwest and move it to a suburb in Seattle and turn it into a $350,000 house?
But right. Put it on a flatbed truck and just drive it up there. Right. Oh, I mean, some of the same houses that we do in the Midwest, you know, with my company, you know, I've had investors from California tell me the same size house in California would be, you know, $700,000. It just blows my mind.
Yeah, I honestly don't know how large parts of our society can afford those houses. It's just beyond my I personally don't invest in those types of markets because I don't understand them.
Yeah, I don't. Well, the money, the ROI doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know how you can't explain how the ROI right. makes any sense at all. So I'd love to know how that makes sense for other people. Well, Brian, it's been great having you here on the show. And you know, I love these chats that we do every few months or so here on the show where we kind of just talk about the market, current market conditions, where things are going, where you're seeing things are heading. And I'd love to have you come back on as we see some shifts and changes. You know, let me know. We'd love to have you back on.
I'd love to be back on sometime in the not too distant future. It's the market's always changing and you just need to stay current with it. That's what's important with today with real estate at any time, really. I thank you, Clayton. It's been great being with you.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Where can people learn more about everything you're working on?
I publish articles at Realty News Biz, Realty Biz News about three times a week. So they can, and my email address is there. My business is Astral Business Services. My email is astralservices@msn.com. I'd be pleased to hear from your listeners.
Wonderful. Well, they will reach out, I'm sure. And please check out everything that Brian is writing on realtybiznews.com. You can check it out. And we will make sure we have that linked up in the show notes for today's episode as well. You can just go over to our show notes page. And this is episode 185. So 185. So just go to morrisinvest.com/episode185 for everything that Brian and I talked about. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you, Clayton.
And thanks to all of you for downloading and subscribing. And thank you for taking action and becoming a real estate investor. We'd love to hear your feedback, questions, ideas for the podcast. You can always leave them on our Morris Invest Facebook page. We've got a vibrant community over there. So any questions, thoughts, hey, I'd love for you to do an episode around this topic. We always do that. We love hearing your concerns and thoughts and questions. And so we'll put them up here on the show and get an expert on to talk about it if we can't answer it ourselves. Until next time, everyone, this podcast publishes three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We'll see you on Monday, everyone. Now go out there, take action, and become a real estate investor.